body is the path guide for mastering these harsh snow mountains. Happy is one who sleeps naked in snow. Wondrous this freedom from heat and cold. Song I sang of eight Vajra paths is itself a path guide, voice self-voiced like echo. Happy the yogi who remembers the song of experience. Wondrous the self-voiced Vajra sound. I offer this song of worship, Holy Lama. Share in this feast of sound, host of Dakini. Remove your obstructions, non-humans. Attend this auspicious song of worship. As he sang, flowers fell from the sky, and a never-before-experienced perfume was smelled. Each of the five disciple repas experienced a different vision. Together, they paid respects and offered a mandala with fervent request that Mila remain with them. Inspired by such uncontrollable faith, favorable meditation experiences were kindled in them, and they were made renewed, and they made renewed effort in practice.
Listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Remembering Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Building Toward Nuclear Justice, on Monday, August 8th from 6 to 7:15 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza on the Portland waterfront. This memorial features speakers and performers representing communities on the front lines of nuclear injustice. That's Remembering Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Building Toward Nuclear Justice, on Monday, August 8th from 6 to 7:15 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza on Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, keeping Portland safe and in touch. Support your independent community radio station, KBOO. You can donate via the KBOO website at kboo.fm/give. There's also a donate button in the mobile app, or you can text KBOO to 44321. But the best way to support KBOO is by becoming a member at kboo.fm/give. KBOO is a nonprofit, listener-supported community resource for people like you. This is Wider Window Poetry, and I am your host, Teal Ansari, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. But first, a word about the places where you are. KBOO Portland is located on land that includes traditional village sites of the Multnomah, Wasco, Cowlitz, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Molalla, and many other tribes who made their homes along the Columbia and Willamette Rivers, creating communities and summer encampments to harvest and use the plentiful natural resources of the area. Portland is home to almost 70,000 people descended from these tribes and others. As a latecomer to this region, descended from slaves and immigrants, I thank the indigenous peoples of the Portland area for their stewardship and for this place of refuge. I do have a guest this month, but first I'm going to read some poems from a collection titled Hong Kong Without Us, which is produced by the Bauhinia Project and Georgia Review. Hong Kong Without Us is a curated collection of quotes from participants in the Hong Kong resistance, published anonymously to protect the authors, who would have been at risk of imprisonment, disappearance, and death were their names to become known to the Hong Kong government. And these are short quotes, so I'm going to read several of them. Anonymous. As a civil servant, I serve my people. But look, 2 million marched, ignored. Our teens bled in the front, condemned. Cops joined hands with gangs, condoned. And you, still dodging our demands. I warn you, the city's mailmen will join Monday's strike. We apologize to Hong Kongers for the inconvenience. And this and the next one were both in the context of a general strike that was held throughout Hong Kong. It's the general strike today, I gently reminded the delivery man. He said, it's hard to close the whole restaurant. I let everyone else strike. Only I'm working today. We have to stay open to feed students on the street. He was the manager. And this is from Anonymous, age 14. Going to the protests on my own? Well, we come to this world alone and leave alone. We are always alone. Why be afraid? This summer taught me nothing's absolute. I just want to be someone who will change society when I grow up. And in the last section of this book, it's made up of dreams for Hong Kong, hopes for Hong Kong, and these were crowdsourced from a social media group that has since been banned, and the participants have had to go underground. And so as I read through these are wishes that the people of Hong Kong have for their city and their home, and I encourage you to think about how these quotes would read if the words Hong Kong were replaced with the words Portland. I want to plant more trees, make fresher air for Hong Kong. My dream is to build bike lanes across the city so our lives won't be trapped by vehicles and the subway system. My dream is to open a tailor shop that fixes people's clothing so we can change our city's deep-seated morbid consumerism. My dream is to be a good civil engineer, building affordable homes for Hong Kong people. And those were quotes from Hong Kong Without Us, produced by the Bauhinia Project and the Georgia Review. You're listening to Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest this month is Reina Tahir. She's a poet and educator living in Portland. She's of Pakistani origin and grew up in Kuwait. She earned an MFA from Pacific University and is now a Kundaman Fellow and a member of RAWI, which I forgot to look up, so I'm going to have to ask you what that stands for. Her work has appeared or is forthcoming from Print Oriented Bastards, Bar Magazine, Poetry Online, and Pellet Poetry, among others. She is the author of two books, a textbook on the life and work of Harlem Renaissance poet Kanti Cullen, and a choose your own adventure novel based on the life of World War II heroine Noor Inayat Khan. Currently, she's working on her next book of fiction, which will be forthcoming in 2023. Welcome, Reina.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm embarrassed that I didn't bother to look this up. Please tell me, what does RAWI stand for?
So it stands for the Radius of Arab American Writers, and then the I is like incorporated. It's kind of a cheat to keep that acronym because Rawi in Arabic is, I believe it's like writer or, you know, reciter or something like that. And so it's kind of like Kundiman, where it's an affiliation group for writers who ascribe or identify as part of a particular group. And it's wonderful. They do absolutely amazing programming, and their community is just so loving and open. I've absolutely loved it. I joined last year, I believe. Was it last year or 2 years ago? Something around there. It was during the pandemic, you know, how the years all
clapping. Oh, I know.
Yeah. It's also weird to say during the pandemic when we're technically still in it, but it just seems like everybody keeps moving on.
Yeah, and I really wonder how much we're fooling ourselves by feeling like things might be back to normal.
Yeah, definitely.
But anyway, so I would like to invite you to read some poetry for us.
Sure. I first wanted to say I loved your reading. And I think this poem would fit into that, considering what is going on in the world. I think the rise of aggression and the rise of like very far right wing authoritarianism is something we're seeing all around. So this first poem comes from a series that I started many years ago. And it's based on interviews I conducted with people who lived in Kuwait or survived or were refugees from the Gulf War in 1991 and the Iraqi occupation that started in 1990. My parents were refugees. Actually, that was the second time my grandparents were made to be refugees, because they were also refugees during the partition of India and Pakistan. And so this is for that, and I really think of especially what's happening in Ukraine right now and how, you know, certain countries feel like they have dominion over others and can choose to force their hand. So this is called Skirmish. More. The eye that should be shriveled, dust, a lifeless planet, not turning on its axis. The roundness, a woman open without skin, a man preserved, hunched over, exposed each bone to shape our form. Shoulders stacked inescapable for the most part, the spine a pattern to build the body by. Every casualty seemed minor, 1,000 dead, a minor war with minor consequences in 6 weeks for a small country that should have been decimated, cried over like some genocide. The truth is, everything is small in Kuwait, even our tragedies. A man says there were a lot of parties and no one suffered a lack of booze in this occupation. He throws back his hand, swathing some broken image in mind, a hospital bed with bloody sheets, his father with a pistol to the head. He talks more. Another man keeps his ID card in his back pocket. When his hair was black like his eyes, he makes a point to show it to me.
That's very powerful. And that certainly does speak to so many things that are happening in the world right now. So your grandparents fled from the partition of India and Pakistan, and then they settled in Kuwait, and your parents, then you were born there?
So basically my grandparents were teenagers during the partition, and they were in Lahore, which saw a lot of incredible fighting and conflict. Traditionally, Lahore is a very multicultural, multi-religious location. And then, of course, the sectarian lines that were drawn arbitrarily just ripped the fabric of that city apart in many ways. And so my grandparents were witness to that. They didn't end up moving to Kuwait until after partition. So partition was 47. And then they moved in the 1950s to Kuwait. But my parents were both born and raised there. And then they met in Kuwait and My siblings and I were all raised in Kuwait.
And then you came to the U.S. So what prompted that decision?
So we used to like vacation in the U.S. Not often, but multiple times. And so to me, the U.S. was always like the world of Disney World. That was my main association. That and a lot of pop culture, you know, Cartoon Network, Nickelodeon, all that good stuff. So I really fell in love with writing from an early age. And when I was in high school, I had recognized that the school that I was at, which was a very good school, and you know, it was more academically driven though than it was artistically at the time. Things have changed since then. And I really wanted to pursue creative writing, not just academic writing. So I looked up schools and I found this place called the Interlochen Arts Academy in Michigan. And I applied there to be a creative writing major. So I actually finished my last 2 years of high school in Michigan. And then from there, just, you know, continued my education until I met my husband in college. And that was pretty much the impetus to stay came from that.
So let's hear some more of your poetry.
Okay. This one is another poem from that same series. And it sort of explains a little bit of what my family went through and sort of this, you know, I'm very interested in mythologies. Like my family, we have a lot of mythologies that explain sort of how we are, why we are. And so this is part of that. It's called Nomad. Behind a gun barrel, my family arrives in Kurdish land, Iraq, only a gold pen to bribe their way. If you come from my family, at some point you must face exile. 40 years earlier, my grandfathers first stepped on Kuwaiti ground. I've inherited this. Any moment can be taken away. In 1947, my grandmothers watched the land split itself in two. Fleeing decades later, my family drives into Iraq, into Turkey, into Iran, into Afghanistan, into Pakistan, with few stops, no money, little food, full car, which upon arrival breaks down. And this next one is called Coming Home. So my mother was actually pregnant with me during that trip. And the reason that they had to go through Iraq was because Iran had actually closed its border with Kuwait, and so no one could go out there. And a lot of people were fleeing to Saudi Arabia as well. But my parents wanted to get to Pakistan, and they were allowing certain nationalities to leave. They weren't allowing Kuwaitis to leave. Iraq was, you know, considering it was dominating and occupying the place, but because we were Pakistani citizens, technically we were allowed to leave. And so my parents had to leave along with many aunts and uncles and my grandparents. It was like a caravan of cars. And they drove through Iraq around and to Pakistan. And then my father came back shortly before they started actually letting people back in. So Iraq, as they were fleeing, they burned all the oil fields. And so it was a huge environmental disaster. My dad came back to Kuwait by himself before that was all cleaned up. So this is called Coming Home. I have learned to rebuild from my parents, the way to smooth the cracks in a wall, that when a bullet shatters the window, new panes of glass can be brought in. My father sleeps on tiled floor the first night he returns to Kuwait. At least that is what I imagine, though I know it is the wrong apartment I dream of, the one with the pink tiles, pink walls, pink curtains blowing in the breeze coming off the Gulf. I know he slept on the floor of the looted apartment because he told me. Everything else I imagine, the dust outlining absence, trapping the memories of what once was. Before papering over what's broken, there is the count. He will try to quantify what home once looked like, before burning skies, before the heaviness of rebuilding. What I know is that he will keep a stray bullet, two artillery shells. I ask, will he keep them to remind him that outside the sky rains ash? This next poem is also from that same series. And so, you know, I was very obsessed with the war because I was born directly after it. And so my early childhood was very much, you know, Iraq and Saddam Hussein, they were like these boogeymen just shadowing over everything. And like there's, I'm a Muslim. And so the, in the Quran, there's the Surah Al-Fil, so the prayer of the elephant, which describes like this battle in which at one point God sends like these birds with stones, like fiery stones to drop on people and stuff. And I used to imagine that, so when I was learning that surah as a kid, I used to imagine like Saddam Hussein. I used to imagine that this was like the Gulf War. That's how much it was in my psyche growing up. And so when I was a young adult, you know, they finally started teaching about the conflict in Kuwaiti schools. They didn't during when I was a student. So my younger sister was actually part of the first generation to actually learn about the war in school. And so I was really fascinated with all the stuff that was coming out. And I remembered, you know, during the lead up to the Iraq invasion, there was a lot of emotional manipulation of the Kuwaiti public to support that war. And so I really just started interviewing people because I finally had access to these stories. And this comes from some of those interviews with people who survived. When asked about his worst memory, he said he didn't want to go back 20 years, using his fingers to show how his heart would explode into miniature fireworks. The estimate comes down to 600 missing. The estimate comes to a son flying off a bridge. In one interview, another man tells me what he lost, an unborn first child, his father. He, in an attempt to be brief, lists all the people in a war who died from normal things, a stroke, an accident, sadness. And then I think this is the last one that I will read from that series. I'll move on to other work. Where I grew up, we lived across the street from the beach, and there's a theme park. It's not there anymore, unfortunately, but it was called, it's spelled Showbiz. But growing up, I didn't realize that, I actually didn't realize it was the word Showbiz until I was almost 30, funny enough, because we always called it Showbiz, because in the alphabet, like the Arabic spelling of it, it looks like Showbiz. So it was right across from our home. And my dad told me the story about how when the occupation first started, you know, he went out to try and get like food and things, you know, everyone's panicking, don't know what's going on. Because it really did just happen overnight. It was, my parents went to bed on August 1st, 1990, and then woke up and there were tanks in front of the house, or in front of the apartment. So he was driving back from picking up like gas and things that we would need. And these Iraqi soldiers stop him and they tell him that they basically want him to drive them to another location. And so my dad is kind of terrified because, you know, these are armed soldiers, who knows what's going to happen. But he realized that they had no idea where they were. So they had no idea where they were going. So what my dad ended up doing was driving them to that amusement park and dropping them off there because they wanted to go to like the complete other side of Kuwait. My dad was like, I'm not gonna trust, you know, going all the way there and then assuming they'll let me come back. So he drops them off there, and I've always just been, and then races home. I've always been enamored with this idea of these soldiers at this amusement park that I used to go to as a kid. So this is called Soldiers in Showbiz. Along Al-Balajat, where the Gulf comes, a moment staring at their surrounding, left them stranded in a firebombed pizza palace with arcade games and animatronic bears. There, years later, malfunctioning or starting suddenly, a kiddie coaster shaped as a caterpillar, traveling fast without seatbelts through an apple made of metal frames and golden string lights. On one side, my parents. On the other, the open sea.
Wow. You know, abandoned amusement parks are really sort of creepy just by themselves, even without that association. But I'm curious, what did your father tell the soldiers to get them to think that this was the place they were meant to go?
You know, it's really interesting. So I have a lot of, when I was doing this project, I ended up having a lot of sympathy for Iraqi soldiers, because what I found was they didn't want to be there. You know, I think of it sort of like the news reports we're hearing about Russian soldiers who are being forced into Ukraine against their will, you know. With the Iraqi soldiers, like many of them didn't have proper supplies, didn't have proper uniforms, didn't have even shoes. It was such a haphazard invasion. So they didn't actually know where they were, or they didn't have any intelligence of any kind, like the average soldier. And so they had wanted to go, I think they wanted my dad was in this area called Salmiya, and they wanted him to drive them all the way to Ahmadi, which, like I said, is really, really far away. And so what my dad did was he just drove them to the street, Al-Balajat Street, where the amusement park is, and just said, oh yeah, if you just walk down this street a little more, you'll be in Ahmadi. So they were like, okay, they had no reason to question it, right? They didn't have any intelligence at all. And so they get out, they walk, and my dad just zooms home. I always wonder what they were thinking when they got there, and it's like the only thing is this firebombed, wrecked place. And there were some trenches nearby on the beach, so maybe they found other soldiers. But yeah, it's just nuts. I can't believe my dad got away with that, frankly. That was very dangerous.
That's a great story, though.
Yeah.
So let's hear some more of your different work, and then I would like to ask you some questions about your process.
Sure. Okay. So this is, these poems really deal with more recent things in my life, my childhood, and I guess that's not recent, but you know what I mean, post-war things, childhood, my immigration story, things like that. So this is called Off the Knife. How I dared to eat food directly off it, licked the edge to see if it could cut. How I chopped heads or feet of baby carrots and lettuce snapped. When renovating the bathroom, I poked at the exposed metal piping, thought how hard it would come down. In the living room, two missile shells held fake sunflowers. When empty, they tipped over easily and echoed as I howled in them. When sleeping, we're just practicing. A bullet left over years ago stands at attention as if shot out again on the display case with the crystal knickknacks by the dining table. Using nylon ropes, my family leashed the sheep at Eid as it sat in the garden before we brought out the knife again. Another one, this is, this actually was just published in Talat Poetry. And it's again to do with my childhood. It's called Belief. I never could hold the taxidermy turtle without wincing at the decay that was not there. Instead, I took down the conch shell with its former inhabitants, dried and disintegrated, and pressed it to my ear, hearing a faint shushing sound when really it came from the waves outside, which died down every night as the gulf receded to reveal the slimy, combed sand that turtles could be born in, might be born in, will be born in. When the adhan breaks across the sky, the seas come back to prey. I will believe most things easily. I will believe the turtle is alive and the conch shell controls the sea and that prayer leads to answers, because what's worse, knowing that dead things sit in the chest, damp from polish, that an empty home filters the sounds from outside, that my father's rage comes in waves, or believing that if I am good enough, I could press my ear to his chest and know.
This is KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. You're listening to Wider Window Poetry, and my guest this month is Rena Tahir. So besides poetry, you also write both fiction and nonfiction, which is quite a diverse body of work for a writer. Do you feel like those three genres sort of live in different parts of your brain, or is it all kind of one thing?
I think that they do live in different parts of my brain, but those parts are all interconnected. I think that each of those types of writing just naturally lend themselves to different topics or different things that I'm passionate about. So I actually came to poetry last. Poetry was the genre that I actually hated for a lot of my life. And that just comes to, with like a lot of students, you first engage with poetry in school and it's not necessarily introduced to you in the best way or the most accessible way. So I just generally had a disdain for it. I originally wrote a lot of fiction, specifically science fiction and fantasy, which I still write today, because I just loved those books. I loved reading them. And I always imagined, how you could approach social commentary through those genres was particularly special to me, especially growing up in Kuwait, which has very strict censorship laws. And so this is a way to sort of get around that and be able to talk about these things without necessarily being direct. When I, coming of age during the war on terror years, I became very political. And when I was politically activated and I guess gained a little more strength and determination to call things out directly, that's when I really started writing nonfiction. And that was, that was a stepping stone. And then finally I got to, when I went to high school at Interlochen, that's where I was introduced to poetry in a new way by a wonderful teacher, Teresa Scull, and she's also a poet herself. And she really opened my eyes to the possibility of what poetry could do and how it could merge sort of those fantastical and beautiful elements of science fiction and fantasy writing with the hard truths of nonfiction. And it was just a wonderful class. I absolutely love her. And I really do credit that class with saving my life in many ways, because I didn't know how to express the things from my childhood that were still haunting me, the things from my upbringing or where it came from, and my new experiences as an immigrant, as an international student, and poetry was the place where I could do those things.
So I'd love to explore that intersection a little more, because, there are some questions around fiction versus nonfiction and the issue of honesty, which I think most authors resolve by saying, well, if it's fiction, then you have an agreement with the reader that you're telling a story that may embody some truths, but is not necessarily factually true. And with poetry, there isn't necessarily that agreement. So, you can write a persona poem, which is from the point of view of an I, but somehow the reader's supposed to understand that the I is not really the poet, and whatever the I in the poem is experiencing is not necessarily anything the poet has experienced. And then that can open up questions of appropriation and other forms of dishonesty. So how do you negotiate that in your own work?
That was something I really struggled with, especially with those Gulf War poems, because I knew that, I wasn't born yet when all of that happened. I was born in, months after everything was resolved. And so I knew going into that, that I was really an observer and not a participant, even though I felt so strongly about the issue. And so I struggled a lot with authenticity and who am I writing this for? Why am I writing this? What needs to be said? And ultimately from that experience, what I found was, and I think a lot of writers find this, there's lowercase t truth, which is, you know, the factual, like, here's what happened, who, what, where, when, why. And then there's the capital T truth, which is really about what is the significance? What are the things that we learn from these experiences? What are the truths, the universal truths that come from that? And I hesitate with the word universal. I think it's in writing circles, it's a very politicized term in many ways, because, you know, what is universal is usually white or Western, and everything else is relegated to not really universal, even though, you know, Europe is a small portion of the world. So, but, you know, there are things that we learn from these experiences that in poetry, I feel supersede the lowercase t, but you can see me negotiating that in certain poems, like with the Coming Home poem. You know, I just explicitly tell the reader, I'm imagining this. I don't know. You know, I know a little bit about it, but I don't actually know. And so those are ways to get around that, I guess, that question. But ultimately, I think of, you know, if it's true to me, with poetry, if it's true to me, then that is good enough. And I just acknowledge that a poem is just a snapshot. It's just going to give me or give the reader a certain view. So for example, with the poem Belief, you know, I say my father's rage comes in waves. You know, that's one aspect of my father. It's not exploring everything. I think I used to struggle, and the reason I went to fiction and nonfiction originally was because there are way more words. So you can attempt to try and fit everything in. With poetry, you just can't do that. You have to accept that you're going to have to make cuts. You're going to have to distill what is most important, which is a great skill. But that's how I see it. I think that truth is, I don't want to say that it is not important, because it certainly is, especially in this world of disinformation that we're currently living in. But when it comes to that in the arts, it's really more about emotional truth to me personally.
Great. So let's hear a few more poems.
Okay. So this is a poem that really talks about my experience in Michigan. So when I left Kuwait, you know, Kuwait's a desert. I'd been in snow maybe once or twice in my entire life. And then I went to Interlochen, Michigan, which snowed out of the 9 month school year. It was like 7 of those months we were just covered in snow. It was a huge shock. And I think because I don't have an accent, my English is pretty strong, people sort of assume that I don't experience much culture shock, but the culture shock was very strong. And I was in a lot of depression actually around that time too. I was very homesick. And what I ended up doing was I was introduced by one of my teachers, Michael Delp, to the poet Jim Harrison. And Jim Harrison and I, we are very, very different. But for some reason, my 16-year-old self was just, I love this poet. I love their work. I love their writing. Something within it resonated with me. And so when I first started writing poems, they were actually all letters to Jim Harrison. A lot of my writing process, I still start as a letter to him. And specifically in response to his book, Letters to Yesenin, who's a Russian or Soviet poet from the 1920s. So this is Letter to Jim Harrison 4. I know the tender work of tying knots, how ropes and hands can fold into themselves, how bodies can grow swollen on anything. The spider bite, leaving my entire leg inflamed, was barely a centimeter of skin. This is love. In Michigan, I counted ceiling tiles, measured their gravity against mine. He was lucky. He had the will. I thought of you in summer, and my nose bled, my ankles hurt, the added weight of you. The sparrows you mention in almost everything must always be the same ones, ones you would watch beating against their chests, ready for flight to places only ropes could take us if you were truly willing. On the chair, you're not here to stop me. You're off looking for something you and I have already found. Love saved me the $2 I would have spent on rope already made. It could not save anything else. I look at pictures of him in his casket and think of the loves that killed him, the ballerina, the vodka, the poems. Or was it one of us that finally helped him over the edge? The distance between toes and the edge of a chair is nothing until you leap. But forget all that now. This methodical braiding of three strands leaves me panting at the muse. Yusenin.
I should have said a trigger warning at the beginning of that because it does deal with Yusenin actually committed suicide, or some believe that he may have actually been killed by the KGB. And Jim Harrison, when he was writing his letters to Yusenin, he was contemplating suicide. And I have a long history of suicidal ideation and attempts. So I was really writing, I think that's what spoke to me in those poems. That's why I adhered to him, was that was the first time that I could really express those feelings. And I think it helped that I felt like I was expressing them to him, somebody who I imagined could understand.
I have another poem that is in that similar vein. This is much more recent. This I wrote actually during, it was the only poem I wrote during the shutdown in 2020. And it took me months to write. It's probably one of the longest poems I've ever written too. But it deals with a lot of those same issues. And it is called Sura for the Birds. And if anyone ever wants to see it, it's on Bahar Magazine's website. That's B-A-H-R. Because I do, like, visually, I use the separators that are in the Quran. So there's no punctuation in the Quran. There's just those circles that number the different verses, basically. And I use that instead of a lot of punctuation in this. Sura for the Birds. Yesterday, I heard the birds alight into the blossoming trees of the neighborhood, feeding and mating, entwined from the beginning with the rising line of dawn. Though I've spent the season planting a garden on the balcony, I have not seen their delicate heads among the bee balms and lupines, nor the lilies, bleeding hearts, or honeysuckle. The aster, pinched back to make room for color, stared upward for them through the day, a loneliness built on echoes. From my phone, the muezzin sounds, and I shroud my head in a cloth of threaded petals to recite the words and prostrate in their direction. They keep their distance, singing to each other the joining call, a plea for coupling. They search as I do to fill a longing, a honeyed dark deep in their breasts. I have been close to birds only in cages or dead, lined up according to size, round heads tucked into their soft bodies. The chickadee, limp in my palm, stared sideways at me, my reflection a wisp on its new glass eye. Like those birds, delicately preserved, I have been provided for. My garden blooms. Inside the apartment, there's fresh pita, wet dates, and the blackest olives. My life in bloom. Inside, there is the weed. It coils tightly around my lungs, weaving through my ribs. It was not enough to hold it dead and count its feathers, to hold it dead and feel its stuffed weight, to hold it dead and press its beak into my thumb,
to hold it dead, mistaking a bird for when it ceased to be a bird. This is just an approximation. I know the truth of birds through sound. I know they live in the trees I can see from my balcony, so close and determined to stay away, hidden in the leaves from me. I love that which leaves me easily, that which I try to draw back. The moon fades into the morning, a faint outline in the sky as azure gives way to periwinkle. Still they sing, still I am alone. I always pray alone when I do pray, which is not often anymore. The moves are mechanical, the words I know only through translation. If I do not concentrate, the rak'ahs will blend together. I will skip whole lines of a surah. In sajda, I press my forehead to the ground, touching it from the bridge of my nose to the tip in one straight line, and sing the call, a plea for closeness. I have never prayed properly. Each year, I learn something more I was missing, how my toes should line up on the prayer mat, how to say, how perfect is my Lord, the highest, when I used to say, God, how perfect you are, please come to me, mistaking the words for their roots. In dua, I beg. There's no other way to say this. When I was six, I knelt next to the body of a dead sparrow on the playground and thought this might be the only chance I'll ever have to hold what had never been caged. The religion teacher said to keep my distance from something unclean. I cannot say what killed it. No blood, no cut, no broken wing. Only that it died alone, its smooth eye reflecting clouds and my shadow against them, ants in neat lines to gather what was left. Someone picked up the body and threw it away. Someone picked up my faith and threw it away. Did he not say he would keep some of us blind? Did he not say some would try to find their way only to be led further astray? I turn to each shoulder in salam, and still no creature draws near, no wings flutter in the corners of my sight. The world still with the blue, still with this chirping homily, still with this distance. After the sparrow, I told my father I was afraid to die, and he told me to go to bed. I begged, and he yelled at me, confirming what I knew to be true. If the sparrow and I are the same, what do I make of the flowers in my garden, the scent of jasmine reminding me of all the homes I have left? They wait for rain and sun and unfurl themselves. I put the prayer mat and the cloth my grandmother embroidered away, provide tap water for my garden, cast off their dead leaves to make room for new growth. The birds stay in their trees out of reach from my unclean hands. In small dishes, I leave gifts for them, flesh of the fruit and its seeds, tangles of my hair for nesting.
This is Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest this month is Rana Tahir. So I'd like to switch gears for a minute and have you say a couple of words about your two published books. So one is about the Harlem Renaissance poet Kanti Cullen, and the other is about Nora Inayat Khan, who I think is probably less familiar to most of my listeners than Kanti Cullen. So if you could say a little bit about each of those.
Sure. So both of those are works for hire. So if you're not too familiar with the publishing industry, publishers will often seek out writers to write things like textbooks or series books, things like that. And so with the first one on Kanti Cullen, it was part of a series of textbooks, each focusing on a specific artist of the Harlem Renaissance. And so for that, I did research on Kanti Cullen and his life and his work, and sort of built that into a narrative. And the book followed a certain structure that the series had. It was great fun to work on. I feel very connected to Kanti Cullen as a person and a poet. I feel like he's very underrated, not within, I think especially Black artists, they know County Colin. But to those of us outside who are only learning about the Harlem Renaissance, like, he's not very focused on a lot, even though you could argue that his first book was really the beginning of the Renaissance. It started that same time period, and he was very, very prominent in his time. He was also a great curator and promoter of Black art. So, you know, he was known later on for his editorial work, where he would really promote other Black artists. And he was a contemporary and a friend slash maybe frenemy of Langston Hughes. So that book, that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of research, and I love research and writing. Most of my projects, as you can probably tell from my writing, have a lot of research components. And yeah, that was just a great learning experience. The second book, it's called Choose Your Own Adventure Spies, Noor and Nayat Khan. And that is part of the Choose Your Own Adventure book series. So older listeners may be familiar with that series, where you basically follow different paths to different endings. And this was based on the life of Noor and Nayat Khan. So I researched her life, and then I built it into a fictional narrative. So that was an interesting process, because with her, I had to create a character out of who she actually was. You know, with the textbook, it's really just explaining, here's what we know about County Colin. With Noor, it was really, okay, who is she? If I were to distill her down to some key elements that guide the decision-making process that she made through her life, what would that be? And how would I use that to guide the decision-making process that a reader might take in the book? And, you know, I found that she was very, very empathetic, very justice-oriented, and she saw that as part of her faith. So for those who don't know Noor, she was a woman of Indian and American descent. So her mother was white, I believe Irish-American, and her father was from India. And he was a Sufi leader. So she was actually born in Russia, and then her family moved to France, and that's where she was raised. And then when the Nazis invaded France, she fled with her family to the UK. And that could have been the end of her story. She, as a Sufi Muslim woman, she could have just stayed out of the conflict. She was also a pacifist by her beliefs, but she saw the Nazis as, I mean, what we all see them as today, which was a very particular threat to the world and to justice. And so she felt, despite her pacifist beliefs, you know, that she wanted to be a part of the effort to remove them. And so she joins the SOE as a spy, as a radio operative for the British. And she is sent back to France. And she was actually one of the longest surviving spies in France. Most other spies, they lasted, from my research, at least from what I read, they maybe lasted a few weeks, a couple months, but she lasted quite a while, and she gathered a lot of intelligence for the Allied forces. Unfortunately, she was ultimately betrayed. They believe that she was betrayed possibly by a double agent who was working with her, or even possibly one of her neighbors, her former neighbors. And so she was captured and then interrogated, tortured, and ultimately executed by the Nazis. But, you know, I think it's amazing that it's the story of this woman who was a writer. That's actually what her day job, and she was a writer. She wrote children's stories, and you can still buy some of her stories, like if you go on Amazon or Bookshop, you know, forget Amazon, go to Bookshop. And you can see her writing. She took sort of folk tales and myths from India, from her childhood, and translated them into English. And that's what she wanted to do her whole life. people described her as a storyteller. But in the face of this great injustice, you know, she takes the call of action, and I just find it so inspiring. I can't imagine doing that. She really, especially as a woman in those times, you know, there was no expectation for women to be part of any armed conflict or war, but she believed in justice so wholeheartedly. It was such a huge tenet of her faith that she made the ultimate sacrifice.
Great. So I'd like you to say a couple words about the Oregon Poetry Association, which you're on the board of, and I am a member and was also previously on the board of. What should poets living in Oregon know about this association? What kind of work does it do?
Well, the Oregon Poetry Association is really a great way to sort of connect with poets across the state. We also take, we have members in Washington as well, because Washington doesn't actually have a state group for poetry. So we take a lot of Washington members as well. And it's just, if you are a poet and you're looking for community, that's ultimately why I joined. I was new to the area, didn't know many other writers aside from the people I went to school with who came from all over the country, so not all of them stayed in Oregon. And you know, you can just meet other poets from different areas. There's lots of events going on, readings. We host workshops sometimes too. We're actually hosting our conference. We do a yearly conference, and we're looking for proposals. So if you are interested in presenting at our conference, it's going to be virtual this year, please check out our submittable to see how you can submit a proposal. But it's just a wonderful way to network and meet others. And I joined the board as the treasurer. I'm now the outgoing treasurer. I will not be returning. But in that role, I really got to know a lot of organizations in Oregon, in Portland, but in Oregon generally. And it's just a great way to expand those circles. It's also a way to give to your, like, to act upon your literary citizenship, if that makes sense, you know, to be a contributor to the art that we love. So yeah, I encourage people to go to OregonPoets.org to check it out. You might actually even get an email from me, because I'm acting as the webmaster right now.
Great. Okay, let's have one more poem, and then I'm going to close with a completely random question.
Okay. Let's see. I'm going to read this one. So one of my teachers at Interlochen, Jack Driscoll, he was married to a brilliant woman named Lois Driscoll, who I absolutely love. I call her my goddess. I took every class I could with her. She was brilliant. And he would always, at the end of his readings, he would dedicate a poem or something to her. And I always loved that. I always loved looking at her as he read the poems to her, things like that. And so when I fell in love with my now husband, I've taken up that tradition. Lois unfortunately passed away recently. So my heart goes out to Jack. I love her so much and I miss her terribly. So this is a poem, a love poem to my husband, that I wrote for Tupelo Press's 30 for 30 poems. So if you're unfamiliar, it's basically each month Tupelo Press hosts some poets who get to write a poem each day for 30 days for a whole month, which was such a struggle. And this was actually the last poem I wrote for that. I want to write more poems with the moon and pink chai, with spring leaves and rosemary, with my hand in yours. I want to write more love poems and use the word gratuitously. Love, 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 love. Oh, how I love thee. Let me count the days I have loved you. Let me describe how I love your smell, your eyes, your smile, your voice, your throat, your chest, your different colored body hair, the scar above your eyebrow. I want to write more love poems with sex, with our sweat, with your heat, with the way you get hungry and I always get my best sleep after. I want to tell the world about how you hold me at night,
how even when it is too hot to be held, I place my foot on your leg to keep us touching through the night. I want to write all the things that I'm too embarrassed to admit I feel. Oh, I thought I was so strong and independent, and though I know I could be again, I want to live in the world with your love. I want to help you trim your beard and hair. I want to ask you for hot chocolate every day. I want to love you forever and keep asking you every day, can I love you forever, please?
Aww.
Yeah, I'm very cynical when it comes to love, so it's a miracle to most people who know me that I'm married and in love, frankly.
All right, what's a food you've always wanted to try and why?
That is a hard, okay. So this is a funny one. I did a project in elementary school on Scotland, and I've always wanted to visit, and I've always wanted to try haggis. I know that sounds weird, but I don't know. It just, you know, it's captured my imagination. So I've always wanted to try it. I've always wanted to go to Scotland. I hope, you know, in my lifetime that I'll be able to. You know, also love to all my Scottish people, you know, all of us oppressed by the British. solidarity. Yeah, that's just, I don't know, it's captured my imagination.
All right, you've been listening to Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest this month was Rana Tahir. And as always, stay safe, stay well, and listen in again next month. Thank you and goodbye.